Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today's episode, we are going to dive into a mirror for magistrates. I was going to say a book. It's not a book. It's sort of an ongoing series of books, a series of works that has a surprising impact to the early modern period. And it is also a return for us to the extended William Baldwin universe, as we have touched upon the work Beware the Cat, both on stage and in discussion, and we are returning to the well, as it were, for a bit more of his work as the founder of this work, Mirror for Magistrates. Now, those who are our patrons will know that I have been reading Mirror for Magistrates as bonus exclusive content over on the Patreon. But we are also working towards doing a live show based on some of the early poems in the work. So, and for that, we have a wonderful panel of experts joining us on stage. But some experts are too far away for even our budget to get into a theatre in East Anglia. So today I have a wonderful guest to talk about its edition of the first two books of Mirror for Magistrates. So my guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Thank you, Robert, and thank you everyone who's listening in today. My name is Scott Lucas. I'm professor and head of the department at the English Fine Arts and Communications Department at the Citadel, the Military College of South Carolina, a military college that's not affiliated with the federal government, but there are still a few in America that are left that are with state schools rather than with the U.S. military. And my specialties are English Renaissance poetry and prose, although I do have a good interest in drama. And I have edited the Mirror for Magistrates, the William Baldwin II editions. I'm very interested in early and mid-Tudor literature of all kinds. That's my specialty.
So I sort of danced around it in the introduction, but what is A Mirror for Magistrates? Because it's not a book; it's a project in a sense that sort of runs away with all the original creators. Tell us a little about the book itself.
A Mirror for Magistrates can best be described as a compendium of historical verse tragedies. Tragedies in the sense of Chaucer's Monk's Tale, in that they tell of the falls of great men and women into misery or untimely death. And their form is usually referred to as De Casibus tragedy, since the mirror looks back to Giovanni Boccaccio's De Casibus Virorum Illustrium, a 14th century text, and the first collection of such tales that formed its model. And the Mirror for Magistrates itself focuses just on figures from England, Scotland, and Wales as the speakers. And it has the innovation of having a ghost come back from the dead. And instead of having a poet simply tell the story of a fallen figure, the fallen figure rises from the grave and tells the story him or herself. And this was a work that was written by a number of hands. There were seven at least, or eight, I should say, at least in the original, and nine, if you count the fact that John Skelton, who had died before it was first compiled, one of the contributors, evidently didn't want to write his own poem on the death of Edward IV. So, and he just had John Skelton's poem at hand and gave it to the group there. And that the first edition came out in 1559 after a very rocky beginning, which I can cover later on if that's of interest. It was an instant hit. Everyone seemed to want to come and see these figures who were from actual history, British history, from about 14th century, let's say, up through the death of Edward IV, and wanted to see these figures tell about their stories and also relate them to the current events of the time. In particular, the idea of a mirror for magistrates would be for the officers of England, including the monarch herself, to look in the poems and say, for the characters who are villains and who end up having their tragic downfall through their own misdeeds, am I that person? Am I seeing in Richard II? Am I seeing myself, Queen Elizabeth might ask? Am I acting like Richard II? Do I want to end up like Richard II? Then I can amend my ways. And so this was a moral concern as well as a literary concern. And then later, William Baldwin began to compile a new collection of tragedies that would expand into the short-lived reign of Edward V, and then, of course, Richard III, prime material for a work of tragedy, all the way into Henry VII's reign, certainly is where he wanted to go, and probably into Henry VIII's. Unfortunately, he died in the middle of compiling this work, and it was put out in sort of a hybrid form in 1563. But the fact that it was not fully completed and needed some revising did not make any difference to the people of England when they got a hold of the second edition of the Mirror for Magistrates, which was even more popular than the first. And it continued to attract poets who contributed new poems to the collection through decades. And the last edition was 1610, and it had grown from that point from 19 poems in the Voices of Historical Figures from 1559 to over 90 poems in figures in historical figures, this time stretching all the way back to King Arthur and up towards Thomas Cromwell in Henry VIII's reign. Really just one of the major hits of the Elizabethan period. Some say that maybe only Sternhold and Hopkins' Psalms and maybe Tottel's Miscellany outsold it over the long life that it had.
It's got several innovations that I really like. I mean, the actual tragic poems themselves, this form of the ghosts coming forward, and with any compilation work, the poems vary in quality and what they're trying to do. But they're strung together by this wonderful extended editorial meeting. The semi-fictionalized account of how the book is being written while you're reading it. And it's fascinating, especially when you look back to also William Baldwin's Beware the Cat, which again has this sort of sense of it's setting itself, the book, within the context of writing the book. It balances between the two in a really interesting way, because you get these historians discussing, well, which source are we using here? People, I think you'll find the two sources don't agree. Which one are we going to follow? Which is a fascinating conversation about what is history at a point when ideas about how to write history are evolving.
That's a very good way of putting it, Rob. And I think that the prose frame, as they call it, for the Mirror is element of the Mirror that really can stand more scholarly investigation. So if there are any scholars out there, please turn your attention to the prose of the Mirror for Magistrates, because as Rob said, it really is an interesting self-conscious presentation of poets deeply interested in history coming together to talk about how they're going to write their poems and whether their poems are valid because they follow one historian, I should say, Robert Fabian, or do they follow another historian, Edward Hall? Because sometimes Hall and Fabian do not agree, and they have to argue, what are we doing here? How can we find out? And should we pick the historian who helps us teach a moral lesson the best, rather than who is the most accurate in terms of the likelihood of his history being the correct one? Some of the poems are of varying quality, as they say, but certainly for the mid-Tudor period, not quite as horrible as it might seem to the 21st century. But they certainly talk about that as well. Should we allow this in? It's not the same meter as our other poems. So it's really poetics, it's history, and it's just a fascinating glimpse into the working of a group of poets and who are historically oriented poets.
So William Baldwin is at the forefront of pulling this collection together, and it gets printed in the early days of Elizabeth's reign, but its crucible of creation starts earlier and at a very different historical moment. So can you say a little about Baldwin and the creation of the project?
Yes, William Baldwin is just a fascinating character who I hope that people will continue to come back to again and again to explore, because he is understudied, even though he was one of the most popular and important figures of the Tudor period. But he lived and wrote at a time before the Golden Age, as C.S. Lewis called the era of Sidney and Spencer. And his poetry was judged backwards from those whose tastes were formed by Johnson, Donne, Sidney, Spencer. And it just wasn't up to snuff. But certainly people of his own time thought he was a wonderful writer and kept him alive for many decades. He was probably born about 1520. He was born in 1526, just possibly 1527. And there's suggestion is that his father was a stationer, a member of the Stationers Guild, who at that time were not necessarily printers, but supplied the kind of things that printers needed, paper, ink, and elements such as that. His father was also, if indeed it is his father, we have no certain evidence, but the best evidence suggests his father was a man named Thomas Baldwin. He was a vicar choral in St. Paul's Cathedral, which meant he helped to sing in the traditional Catholic services with the priests for the masses and for the prayers. And that meant that young William was allowed to have perhaps a education at St. Paul's Cathedral at this Vicar Choral School, where they was going to be trained to be a vicar choral. So he learned how to read Latin. And that helped him out quite a bit because he was not going to university. The next, I guess, reference we have to him after his birth, which he stated was around then, back in Elizabeth's reign, looking backwards, was 1547, when he wrote a commendatory sonnet, I should say, to a work of physic, as they called it then, medicine. And it was printed by Edward Whitchurch, who was Baldwin's employer. Whitchurch was one of the most foremost printers of King Edward's reign and Henry VIII's later reign. And notably about this sonnet that commends this text, Baldwin wrote it in the style that would come to be known as the English sonnet form. It was the three quatrains and a couplet, and it was created by Henry Howard, the poet, Earl of Surrey. He did not publish anything that he wrote in terms of poetry, just one single poem perhaps, but it was never in his sonnets. So Baldwin must have had access to Surrey's poetry, this nobleman, in manuscript. And Baldwin's is the first known sonnet in the English form that would influence so many others ever printed. So we have no earlier evidence for anything before that. So Baldwin was a young man on the cutting edge of literary style. His work with Edward Whitchurch and was soon confirmed in terms of his religion, because Edward Whitchurch was perhaps the foremost evangelical printer of the time. The term evangelical meaning early Protestant. Historians don't usually use the term Protestant for people before Queen Mary's reign. And so he was fervent and was constantly putting out material, including, as many of you may know, he and Richard Grafton were the ones who went to France and tried to get the Great Bible printed, wanting this so badly to have a vernacular English Bible that they paid for it themselves. The French king shut them down, unfortunately, and so they then taught themselves how to be printers, Grafton and Whitchurch did, so they could print it themselves. So Baldwin, it was an evangelical, very strongly reformist. His next work was called The Treatise of Moral Philosophy, a translation of moral maxims, usually only a couplets or so, a couple of lines, some poetry, and others that purported to be from people like Socrates and from the ancient Greeks. Some of them were medieval constructs that Baldwin did not know actually didn't come from the ancient world. But this work became a huge bestseller and was constantly printed and reprinted well into the 17th century. And I believe it was Thomas Nash who said that so many poets just steal Baldwin's aphorisms for their own work, versify them and pass them off on their own, even well into Elizabeth's reign. So he'd become a well-known person in King Edward's reign. His next work was called The Canticles or Ballads of Solomon, an extremely reform-minded evangelical reading of the Song of Songs, that most erotic of biblical books that many would say shouldn't even be shared with the general public, let alone be in part of the canon. Baldwin said you need to read it allegorically as the love song between the church and Jesus Christ. And by the way, if you read into it, this Hebrew text is a prophetic one showing that the Lutheran Reformation and others are the correct way to go, and that there is no free will and good works are vain, and that the justification by faith alone. Baldwin found a lot of really 16th century Lutheran and Reformed doctrine in this Hebrew text that has been causing some controversy ever since that time. But a very fascinating work there, and it showed his religious commitments. His next work, 1550, probably, it's undated, released anonymously, but there were hints in there that it's Baldwin's, was called The Wonderful News of the Death of Paul III. Pope Paul III had died in November of 1549, and Baldwin was no big fan of Pope Paul III, and he found this text written in Latin and written on the continent, probably by the Italian reformer Pier Paolo Frigerio, and he translated it into English. And it shows Pasquill, the famous figure of Pasquinades. And following Pope Paul, when he dies, he sees his soul come up, and the devils all grab his soul and say, "Welcome, Pope Paul, welcome to hell. Let's celebrate all the great things you did up on planet Earth to really make everyone miserable and really cause problems for the true Christian church." And so it's a scabrous satire against Pope Paul and I can see why Baldwin wanted to release it anonymously, because there's a lot of sexual threats, you know, innuendo and things like that in there about Paul and his devious ways. Thereafter, Baldwin continued to work in Edward Whitchurch's shop, and he really was at the forefront of a lot of the most important works that were being published at the time. Book of Common Prayer, Whitchurch was one of the printers. He paraphrases Erasmus's paraphrases of the New Testament. These brought a lot of learned and important men into the print shop. And it may be through those connections, and certainly through his friend George Ferrers, or Ferris, as I think he was pronounced during that time, one of the Mirror of Magistrates authors, that he was invited to come to court and to present plays before King Edward VI for the Christmas revels of 1551 and 1552. And so this brought him to the center of power. He was also joined by Sir Thomas Chaloner, one of the other Mirror for Magistrates authors at this time. This may be where they first got the idea of working together on a project. He then returned with George Ferrers in 1552-1553 to Edward VI's court, where he put on Christmas revels, and this is the beginnings where he imagines a discussion about whether animals have the power of speech. That brings out his next work, Beware the Cat, about a man who allegedly at least discovers a sort of medicine that will allow him to understand what cats say when they talk to each other. And needless to say, cats watch what you do. Whenever you think no one's looking, the cat's looking at you. And the cats share with each other some of the ridiculous things you do behind closed doors. And there's a many, what they called back in those days, merry tales told in there, all in the context of this discussion during the court revels about whether animals have sentience and can speak or not. That work was never allowed to be published because Edward VI died in July of 1553, and it had a lot of anti-Catholic elements in it. His last work before, that's for sure Baldwin before the Mirror, is 1553, The Funerals of King Edward VI, where he imagines a discussion in heaven between God and Jesus Christ about whether, in the face of all the wickedness and immorality and irreligion of the people of England, who refuse to properly reform themselves according to the proper Protestant kind of ways, that God, should he just wipe out all of England altogether, or should he just punish them by taking away their chief jewel, King Edward VI, that young reformist, teenaged monarch? He decides the latter. And so Baldwin explains how all this comes about, where Edward was taken for the sins of the English, and if they don't reform more and become more Protestant, they're going to get in a lot of trouble. Unfortunately, Queen Mary came to the throne, who was at first a religious conservative in the sense that she wanted to return things to Henry VIII's style of more traditional religion, but then pretty quickly became an open Catholic after that. And there's no way Baldwin's works were going to be published. So both Beware the Cat and Funerals of Edward VI did not come out until the early 1560s, when Elizabeth was on the throne. And that was followed by another censored work, A Mirror for Magistrates, or at the same time, I should say, which came out in 1559. Just to round out this lengthy discussion of Baldwin's career, I'll mention that while he was putting out his works that had not been allowed under Mary, he became a minister. He became a chaplain to Henry, 10th Baron Stafford, who was one of the Mirror contributors, and he got a benefice, and his church was St. Michael Le Cerne Church in London, right across the street from St. Paul's Cathedral, which is in its churchyard, was where the major center of printing was. And so Baldwin was close to the print trade, even as he was ministering in St. Michael Le Cerne. He was so popular that he was invited to give the Paul's Cross sermon, which could attract literally thousands of people just to watch. I suppose they couldn't all hear just a man standing in the pulpit. But he died of plague almost immediately after giving his last sermon at Paul's Cross. Mm. And it was 1563.
Yes, I have to say that it did hit me quite hard when I realized how young he died, because I've basically been inhabiting Baldwin for performing Beware the Cat, because it's sort of a story within a story and within a story. But the outermost story is William Baldwin relating what his friend Ferrers, who's also writing in Mirror for Magistrates, getting to know these people as people, and then realizing that, you know, I'm older than him than when he died. And it really sort of hit me quite hard, you know, how young he was and how much he had done actually in that time in different ways. I mean, we may agree or disagree about his political and religious convictions, but in terms of the output and the fact that I feel I know him and I feel I know Ferrers as well, as people. You know, the Beware the Cat paints him in a very clear sense of as a human being, and both of them as a human being. And so going from Beware the Cat to Mirror for Magistrates, when they're all sitting around discussing which text they want to bring, means they feel very real. And that's another way of approaching Mirror for Magistrates as well.
That's a nice way to think about it. And it's and again, if you're anyone out there interested in working through Baldwin's presentation of the meeting of these seven authors at that one night in presumably London to work out how they're going to do the Mirror for Magistrates, presenting them, I've argued that his presentation combines elements of their first meeting in spring of 1554. And then evidence suggests they broke up and all went their ways over the summer to write their poems and came back about August or September. We know that Sir Thomas Challoner, one of the authors, was there in London in the spring. Then he went to Yorkshire and spent the whole summer there. Didn't come back until August. So they could not have met all again until August or September, and then shared their poetry together. And Baldwin weaves this into an imaginary, I guess you'd say, single setting where they suddenly read something in the Chronicles and they suddenly burst out into poetry, rhyme royal, beautiful verse there for the time. And so how much of this is the actual authors themselves speaking as they actually did, and how much of it is a presentation, an artifice, a literary imagination of realism made by William Baldwin?
It's like those films, the disclaimer at the beginning saying based on true events, you know, so they've telescoped it down into, and by creating this sort of pressure cooker as well of this idea that they're all huddled and it's one night, and in the same way as Beware the Cat is telling a story over an evening, creates a sense of place, a sense of time. And so when you get to the end of the first book and they wrap up the evening and they say, oh, well, we've got time for one more. And, you know, it feels like a real event, even if that is partly a fiction. It gives it a shape as a thing to sit down and read. Obviously, I'm interested in it partly for its dramatic potential. And people at the time were obviously interested in its performability. The poems obviously stick around as well, and the later versions, the sort of spin-offs, are more focused on the poetry than they are about the editorial meeting. That seems to get dropped. But we do have very dramatic settings for some of these poems. It's a question of how thought out they were. I mean, even in the first book, the setup for Richard II's poem describe the place and the setting. You know, he's in St. Paul's, next to this area in St. Paul's. So they actually describe the area. And of course, that St. Paul's doesn't exist anymore. It burnt down. That description is sort of useful as well to say, well, this is what a bit of St. Paul's looked like. Let's set the scene of Richard II, black and blue. And they're playing not only with the poetry within the story, but also setting up the drama of the poem.
Yes, that is a striking scene that Sir Thomas Challoner uses before he gives his poem in the voice of Richard II. Usually they say, so imagine, Baldwin, that the Earl of Warwick, the kingmaker, has come before me, and this is what he might say. Well, Challoner goes full force. He says, you must imagine, Baldwin, that you see him, that is Richard II, all too bemangled, with blue wounds, lying pale and wan, all naked upon the cold stones in Paul's church, the people standing round him and making his moan in this sort. So it is Richard's corpse that has been dumped unceremoniously, this man who was the ruler of all England, the son of the Black Prince, just his corpse filled with wounds, all bruised and mangled, and that the people, the lowest peasant, is standing around staring at him, this once great and mighty man. And suddenly, from this corpse, he starts to moan and makes his moan in this sort. You don't see much of that kind of dramatic power, I guess you would say, in the earlier periods of Tudor literature. So this really was, I think, groundbreaking and innovative, and it brought a pathos to these kind of stories that certainly Chaucer's Monk's Tale didn't have, and maybe Lydgate's Fall of Princes, the model they followed, did not have as well. This is emotion and empathy that one might have with the character. And you can see it pointing the way to the Elizabethan theater.
Again, also going back to Beware the Cat, that this is almost these proto-horror imagery. Much more so sometimes than tragedy, you know, stage tragedies later on where they're doing other work as well. That there is a nightmarish quality to some of the images that they present. And that's that's something again that draws me to them today, in a sense of going, I sort of know this playbook from other mediums and other genres as well.
And again, with making it ghosts, you can make them look back on their lives and just filled with regret, or I should have done that and I didn't do it. George Ferrers is Edmund, Duke of Somerset, who was killed off during the, I guess, the first Battle of St. Albans. In other words, he was part of some of Henry VI's young group, and the Duke of York was going to attack them. But what haunts him is that he helped to bring down Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, the Lord Protector under Henry VI's minority. And even in his death, he says to Baldwin, a commoner, "Baldwin, please understand, I didn't know when I agreed to his death that he had not been committing crimes. I didn't know it was part of a conspiracy." So this, again, this emotional agony of going to your grave and not being able to set right the things you could have set right in your lifetime and being haunted by it for now, for all eternity, really was powerful stuff. And you can see why so many people came back again and again to the Mirror when they could read that kind of emotional drama and pathos to what was basically originally historical narratives.
And we start off with the reign of Richard II, which obviously I'm very focused on at the moment, because we're going to be doing an adaptation of the opening of the book, complete with editorial meeting. We're going to have the discussions as well. We have these figures. We have Tressilian, who listeners may be familiar to our listeners if they've been following our readings of Thomas of Woodstock, the play, and also the third poem on Thomas of Woodstock, and Mowbray's account of this important element of Richard's life, of what happens to Thomas, and the depiction of who Thomas is in this and other narratives of the time, not necessarily quite who he really was. But we have this sort of very much a hate figure is Tressilian, and we've got these other people, Mowbray's life of banishment and you know where he's left at the end of it. We don't get anything from Henry IV directly, but we have these figures, and it's this question of which figures do you pick? Who is the one who made the mistake? Or in the case of Roger Mortimer, bad luck. I mean, it's like, I'm going to do a poem about someone who's just really unlucky. He didn't really do anything egregiously terrible, but he's sort of just, yeah, he got a bit killed.
The story of Thomas Montague, the Earl of Salisbury, the famous warrior in the French Wars in the 15th century. He was conquering all through the county of Maine. He had taken Le Mans. He had done everything great, but he wanted to capture Orléans in France. And to take a look, he went up to a tower and decided to get a lay of the land. A gunner saw him on the wall of Orléans and shot a cannon. And he got hit by some shrapnel from a wall that had collapsed next to him. And unluckily, he just was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that's all he can say is he said, that's all you can learn from my lesson is you can't trust fortune because, darn it, I didn't do anything wrong in my life, but I still died young.
Fortune's wheel turns up a lot in early modern literature and plays. I mean, it's almost an obsession sometimes with playwrights, certainly in a lot of closet drama, neoclassical drama, constantly running on this theme of fortune's wheel, in especially a historical context, these great figures who are crushed by the wheels of fortune. Are there any other sort of themes you think run through the work or anything else? I've sprung that one on you a bit.
Well, for the first edition, and we can go back to Tressilian again, one of the main things I have argued in my work is that to understand a number of the tragedies, you have to understand what the political situation was in which the authors were writing. They were writing under Queen Mary. She was obviously religious conservative to begin with. And then in January 1555, when the Parliament voted to return England to the Catholic Church, openly Catholic then, the known men who were writing for the first edition were all evangelicals, Protestants, but they were not going to be able to say anything about religion in their work. Of course, the printer they were working under was one imposed on Edward Whitchurch's shop. He was a Catholic himself. Imposed by the Marian government because they did not want Edward Whitchurch putting out any more evangelical Protestant kind of material. So he was the one, John Wayland was his name, who commissioned Baldwin to write the Mirror for Magistrates, saying, I'm putting out a new edition of John Lydgate's 15th century Fall of Princes, which starts with Adam and Eve and goes through King John of France in the 14th century. But that's not going to sell a lot. It's 100 years old. What if we added a bunch of new British poems to this, mostly England, but also Wales and Scotland, and that should get some readership up. So these men now had the opportunity to write, and they were thinking about the mistakes made by politicians in the past. They could not resist pointing some of those seemingly historical narratives to modern magistrates under Queen Mary and saying, in rewriting them in such a way as to advance their political views. So Tresilian was certainly a chief justice under Richard II, but his reason he was deposed by the Lords Appellant, which included Thomas of Woodstock and the future Henry Bolingbroke and Thomas Mowbray, was not because he was a corrupt judge, but because he was telling Richard that he did not have to obey the nobles in Parliament who tried to rein him in and keep him in a certain kind of strait. So Ferrers read that in his sources. Fabian's Chronicle just briefly mentions Tresilian. It was the Parliament rules of England that he went back to in the Tower of London to read up on the history of Tresilian, but he could see that was the case. Instead, he wrote a poem in which Tresilian says, "I and my fellows were corrupt judges who for money would change our judgments and interpret the law in any way we felt like that would ever bring us gold. And when our king came to us and said, 'You interpret the laws whatever way I like, and I'll pay you off,' well, that was even more honey in the pot." And so Ferrer says to the people of reading it in 1554, which is when it was first written, although it was not published until 1559, "Don't do what Tresilian did. Do not change the laws to suit the whims of the monarch. Follow the law properly." Ferrers was a lawyer himself, and give proper judgments. He was saying that because there had been a very scandalous case in 1554, Sir Thomas Throckmorton case, in which the Queen's high judges did indeed try to rewrite the treason statute to say that Throckmorton was guilty of taking part in Sir Thomas the Wyatt Younger's rebellion because he had spoken to Wyatt, even though he never took arms against him. Treason was not words in the treason statute. They were trying to make it so. And this was Ferrers's attempt to try to contact them through print, hoping they would pick it up and read it, other judges as well, and say, "Do not do that." So that was one of the themes, I would say, as an example, in reading The Mirror, that if you see that it does not match their purported historical sources, you'd ask yourself, why are they writing this then? What do they want to teach the officers of their own times? And that might be Mary I herself. And thus, when we're reading the Richard II parts, could they imagine that Mary herself might be reading this and say, I need to rein myself in, make sure I don't do anything untoward and so forth in terms of oppressing my subjects, disobeying the laws.
And for that matter, taking out any inconvenient members of my own family, which is sort of the lesson of Mowbray and Woodstock. There's always this question of also, again, trying to find connections with today. And I can't think of any connection with judges being corrupted by government that we could think of in modern times. I don't think I can't think of a single one. So it's a valuable lesson in the sense that it's interesting that Tresilian as a character in the play Thomas of Woodstock, 60-odd years in the future, it very much follows this pattern. This is the setting out of that character. This is the source for so much material for that play specifically.
Again, it'd be fun to be a fly on the wall and say, why did we pick these ones and not other ones? And they do at one point say that. They're looking through the manuscript, through the histories, and say, well, here's a Sir John Morris who died in a joust, and that was tragic. And there was a friar who was crushed to death when Queen Isabella came during Richard II's reign. That's pretty tragic too, but those aren't really as excitingly tragic as some of these other ones that are out there in the world.
It is cherry-picking figures from history and again, pushing different directions. Talking of pushing different directions, the first book is very successful. There is this follow-up edition planned and worked on by Baldwin, but Baldwin dies. And so we get the second part, which is a very, very different, it's similar but different in the sense it's slightly untidy. But we have, for example, this fascinating reboot almost attempt from Thomas Sackville with his induction. The book picks up, but then it feels like, oh, we've got material, but we don't have a thread in the same way as the first part did.
That's a very good point. And I think it comes out of the very fraught problems with the first edition. First edition was supposed to be appended to John Lydgate's Fall of Princes and a new edition of this 15th century work coming out in 1554. They wrote the 19, probably 20 poems for it, printed them all. Baldwin was a printer. He oversaw the printing. They were ready to go. But someone, probably John Whalen, the printer, Catholic printer himself, got a look at what was actually in those poems. And he could see the political resonance there, critiquing things that were going on in Mary's reign. And I think he took them himself to the Lord Chancellor of England, Stephen Gardiner. Gardiner took a look at it and he said, there is no way we're bringing this out. The whole thing was scrapped. So all that work, they thought it would probably never come out ever again, and collapsed. So it was used as scrap paper. The only surviving pieces were found inside the binding of other books that when it was used to strengthen the book covers in the 16th century. So Baldwin, however, was really captivated by this decazepus tragedy idea of telling the stories of ghosts from the earlier period. So he started over and he said, this time I'm going to work from Edward V's reign, the Princess in the Tower, the short little bit that Edward V reigned in his own name before Richard III took over, and work up through Henry VII at least. And he commissioned new poems for this. This is about 1556 or 1557. And it was in this period that he got Thomas Churchyard's famous Jane Shore, which was so influential in future drama and poetry. And also the young Thomas Sackville, local Inns of Court man, wrote The Complaint of Henry, Duke of Buckingham, Richard III's right-hand man who later went against him and was brought to an unhappy end in his uprising. So Baldwin had worked on these. Queen Mary died. He brought out the original gathering then in 1559 of the 20 poems, although only 19 appeared. I think the Humphrey Duke of Gloucester poem was so controversial that he worried about putting it out even in Elizabeth's reign. In the way that it seemed to covertly attack Queen Mary herself. And then, as you said, Rob, he started on when he was encouraged by others to take that material of Sackville and Churchyard and others and release it. But it was written in Mary's reign. The prose passages refer to this king and queen. He needed to rewrite it for Elizabeth's reign. And then he started adding new poems to it. And that was when the Sackville's Induction was added. When he was writing the one in Mary's reign and felt 1556 or 1557, he had it almost complete, but he said, I am not going to make the same mistake twice. He himself evidently contacted someone on the Privy Council and said, would you let this come out? And they, remembering the first edition, said, no way, you're not bringing this out in Mary's reign. So he started to rework it. He put it aside. And it was Sackville who came to him, the famous Thomas Sackville, co-author of Gorboduc, first British blank verse tragedy, who came to him and said, can I have all the poems that you can't publish? I'm going to create my own special work that will go back in time, starting with my Henry Duke of Buckingham, and then go back to the Norman Conquest, I think is where he was heading towards. And so he wrote his own induction, his own introduction, where he imagines being taken down to a Virgilian underworld to see all the people complaining down there, tour de force of the iambic pentameter, which was pretty rare back in those days. Mm. And it just made an impact that you could not believe on the world around him when it came out in 1563. Mm. This is how an English poet can write. These are the flowing lines. And it was extremely influential, especially on further Mirror for Magistrates authors who rushed to try to be the next Thomas Sackville and contribute.
Yes, I mean, the Induction and Gorboduc, they're cut from very similar cloth, and they do work very, very well. And you mentioned earlier the Shore's Wife poem, because Shore's Wife turns up very explicitly in the true tragedy of Richard III and in the Edward IV plays that we have, and is clearly a narrative that a lot of people are dancing around, both in drama but also in wider literature as well. So this volume comes out in a slightly untidy fashion, in the sense, because, say, Baldwin as driving force has died.
And so he added some new Elizabethan prose parts. He had some new Elizabethan poems, his own poem of Lord Rivers. But when he died, in the middle of rewriting it, Thomas Marsh, the printer, just said, what am I going to do now? So he took the unre-edited, unrevised Marian sections and sort of slammed them together with the Elizabethan sections. So about in the middle of it, you suddenly get references back to King Philip and Queen Mary and not to Queen Elizabeth. you do not get the same setting that Baldwin had for the previous work. But as you mentioned, he had changed the theme in 1556 to 57. He avoided politics as much as possible, except in general terms, and instead tried not to let anyone think, this is me being reflected in this mirror, me, this, the right-hand man of Mary I or something like that. And so aesthetics got emphasized more than ever. And there's discussion of the decorum of the poems and the meters of the poems and the proper setting there. And again, with Sackville in particular, a lot more of description of the settings of the works that, again, one can imagine was inspirational to the future playwrights that would be reading the work and coming afterward.
So we've been focusing very much on for this chat on I say your edition, which has come out a few years ago, I think, and covers these, shall we say, the Baldwin iteration. There are other later works that dance through the rest of recorded history and filling in the gaps because nature abhors a vacuum, which I haven't looked at in any detail myself. They're much more just sort of collections of poems, really, rather than a sort of considered work, I think.
Yes, there's the most are written by one hand. John Higgins was the one who followed on, and he was going to look back to early British figures rather than English or Scottish, I should say, or Welsh figures. So he brought out, for instance, King Lear was one of his poems, or Cordelia really is actually the poem that tells the story of King Lear he found in Geoffrey of Monmouth. So he was writing as one voice rather than the multivocal poetry of the earlier mirror. There were rival mirrors. Thomas Blennerhassett, of a soldier on the Isle of Guernsey, if I remember correctly, had nothing to do. So he had a copy of Baldwin's mirror and started writing his own from the Anglo-Saxon period, the Vikings invasion and things like that. And then Richard Nichols was the last of the contributors writing in the Jacobean period, much more of us influenced by Spenser in his writing, in his flowing lines and imagery. There were a few extras. Drayton contributed one poem. Thomas Churchyard contributed a couple more besides the Jane Shore poem. So there were other contributors, but chiefly it became the works of a single hand for every new edition really coming out.
Impact, I think, is the final point before we close this session. It's obviously was incredibly popular, reprinted numbers of times with increasing numbers of editions or changes. What were the primary sort of results on you know, late Elizabethan Jacobean writing and culture?
Well, again, I don't want to step on the toes of any of my fellow Renaissance scholars who focus on drama rather than poetry and prose as I do. But one sees the inspiration this work gave to future playwrights for an emotional presentation of history, for the historical plays, chronicle dramas. Later on, really, you can mount a historical drama and imagine yourself in the guise of the people that you're putting on stage. Really was a sense that the mirror gave to a later time. It had been gestured towards that way by Sir Thomas More's History of Richard III, where he actually had speeches by these men and supposedly dialogue between them. But the mirror, I think, was the major inspiration. And it just opened a new area for plots and for characters, where you might see the university dramas focusing on ancient heroes or Romans. Here you could have drama of your own people. Others who were knocking in the mirror decided to write their own poetic versions of the Wars of the Roses, for instance, Samuel Daniel and Civil Wars and Drayton, love letters between some of the famous Eleanor Cobham and Humphrey Duke of Gloucester, for instance. We're following in that way.
So any plugs of what are you working on? Anything coming out in the future? This won't appear on the podcast for a little while, but anything coming up?
Well, thank you. The Mirror for Magistrates edition that to which Rob has referred is a Mirror for Magistrates, a modernized and annotated edition, modern spelling, glosses, endnotes. It'll be very much more helpful for those who are not well-versed in 14th century, 15th century and 14th century, for that matter, history. It was published by Cambridge at the very end of 2019. Didn't get a lot of press because everyone shut down in March of 2020 for the pandemic. But it's now in paperback and much more affordable than it had been previously. My current project, I am working on two projects right now, one with Dr. Ben Parsons of the University of Leicester. We are doing a study of William Baldwin's Canticles or Ballads of Solomon, his reading of the Song of Songs, reading it in the context of 16th century theology. That'll be an article, I hope, coming out maybe towards the end of this year. And then a larger project with Dr. Rachel Stenner of the University of Sussex, who I know has been on this podcast in the past. She and I are co-editing William Baldwin's Beware the Cat, along with his other shorter works, such as The Wonderful News of the Death of Paul III, Canticles and Ballads of Solomon, Funerals of Edward VI. And we are also including the epistolary prose work, The Image of Idleness, which is not guaranteed to be by Baldwin, but critics seem to be united that he is the prime candidate for many circumstantial reasons. So that'll be published by Boyd Dillon Brewer, and I sure hope we're getting it done this year because I'm eager to see it get out into print and to have Beware the Cat come back in before readers in all levels, popular readers, university readers. It really is an accessible text for the time.
Oh, I can absolutely attest to its readability and its performability. Sometime in the future, there will be a release of the staged reading that I did, and there are other iterations out there in the universe. And I say our discussion on Beware the Cat is also out there as well. But Beware the Cat's not going anywhere, and I will support anyone who wants to do more Beware the Cat. It really is a fascinating work that it's very enjoyable. And I have to say, and I'm not being paid to say this, I very much do enjoy this edition of Mirror for Magistrates. It is excellent and very useful, and I'd say for this kind of work at a very reassuringly affordable price. So do dive in if you are interested in that sort of work.
And thank you for running this podcast. Sometimes over here in the United States, teaching undergraduates, British literature aren't necessarily a part of our national history. And I do worry sometimes that the news about how wonderful Renaissance English literature is doesn't always get out there. So programs like yours are helping to keep it not only alive, but thriving. So thank you for that.
And thank you. And till the next time we return with another discussing episode, it's goodbye from me and from my guest. Goodbye.
Goodbye.